Another Dutch song that Gardner collected is called A Dutch Lullaby. Lullabies are a category of old songs that we do not usually study academically, yet they are sung by mothers everywhere from ancient times until today. Lullabies are simple and soothing. Gardner wrote that the Dutch lullaby was, quote, contributed by Mrs. Oren Hoos, who knew a version in Schoharie Dutch, a dialect similar to that of the Pennsylvania Germans, as well as the present version in English, end quote. I found two fairly local sources of this lullaby in Dutch with comparable English translations. One is from Benjamin Brink, who collected and wrote The Grumbling Wagoner we heard earlier. The lullaby appeared in Brink's History of Socrates that was published in 1902. 17 years later, the same lullaby was published in both languages in a book with a very long title, A History of Old Kinderhook from Aboriginal Days to the Present Time, including the story of the early settlers, their homesteads, their traditions, and their descendants, with an account of their civic, social, political, educational, and religious life. The author, Edward Collier, nostalgically wrote about the Van Schaak homestead, quote, "But none of these distinguished visitors made this homestead so memorable as did the multitude of children born there, several of whom became notable men and women. To them, in their cradle or in their mother's arms, was often sung this old-time lullaby," end quote.
Sleep, little one, sleep. Out of doors there runs a sheep with four white feet that drinks its milk so sweet. Sleep, little one, sleep. Sleep, little one, sleep. Out of doors there runs a sheep. Out of doors there runs a spotted cow. Her calf has closed its eyelids so. Sleep, little one, sleep. As long as it takes to get the job.
There appears to have been a spate of commercial interest in the lullaby called Sleep Baby Sleep, as revealed by the many sheep music publications between 1870 and 1885 in the U.S. Many printed copies credited the words as translated from German. I can only speculate on why this happened. Perhaps the lullaby was performed by someone famous. Perhaps the interest was stimulated by the publication of the Brahms Lullaby in 1868. And perhaps the lullaby fit into the Victorian sentimentality of the period. Or perhaps the high percentage of German immigrants made a good market. My Dutch friend Clara van Beek from Schoharie County told me that this lullaby is still sung in the Netherlands. Quote, "Everyone in Holland knows this song. It is the first song they hear as a baby." She added, "I've sung it to both my daughters as well." End quote. While she is best known for her book published in 1937, Emmeline Gardner began to publish portions of her research just 2 years into her fieldwork in 1914. Encouraged by scholars from Harvard, Columbia, and the University of Michigan, her article titled Folklore from Schoharie County, New York, was published in the Journal of American Folklore. Among the songs featured in her book was the religious folk song, When the Stars Begin to Fall. It was, quote, "contributed in July 1912 by Zilpha Rickmeyer, who had learned the song when she was young from hearing it sung in revival meetings in Conesville and West Conesville," end quote. Although no melody was provided by Gardner, George Ward will sing the verses and chorus to the chorus part of the tune found in the Story of Jubilee Singers with Their Songs by Marsh, published in 1877. The earliest printed version of When the Stars Begin to Fall that I am aware of was published a decade earlier, in 1867, in Slave Songs of the United States. Songs Gathered in Southern States by William Allen, Charles Ware, and Lucy Garrison. But Christian camp meetings and revival meetings were widely attended throughout the United States. In rural areas, as well as in cities, both white and black folks sang revival songs and enjoyed listening to each other sing. These religious gatherings, which could last days, were very popular in New York, where sometimes there were more observers listening to the various preachers than participating believers. It's possible that When the Stars Begin to Fall arose out of an oral tradition and improvisations at camp meetings. Aside from drawing those who sought religious exaltation, the meetings provided a chance for young people to meet members of the opposite sex. The revival meeting thus became a social, cultural, religious event of the first order in rural life. As noted, the melody of the song, as sung by George, appeared in the chorus of the book, The Story of the Jubilee Singers. This book was filled with the repertoire of the Fisk Jubilee Singers. They were students of the traditionally black university that toured along the path of the Underground Railroad in the U.S. and later sang in England and Europe as they introduced their songs to white audiences. The song belongs to the AAAB type of spirituals where a line is repeated three times with a closing tagline. Repetition was essential in the camp meeting spirit, both for emotional emphasis, repetition carried conviction, and as an aid to memory. Very few songbooks were around.
My Lord, what a morning. My Lord, what a morning. My Lord, what a morning. When the stars begin to fall, that's yours next time. Oh, sinner, what will you do? Oh, sinner, what will you do? Oh, sinner, what will you do when the stars begin to fall? My Lord, what a morning. 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 When the stars begin to fall, you sinner, what will you do? Oh, sinner, what will you do? Oh, sinner, what will you do? When the stars begin to fall, my Lord. What a morning, my Lord. My Lord, what a morning. My Lord, what a morning. When the stars begin to fall, you'll cry the rocks and mountains. You'll cry the rocks and mountains. You'll cry the rocks and mountains. When the stars begin to fall, rocks and mountains, they won't hide you. Rocks and mountains, they won't hide you. Rocks and mountains, they won't hide you. When the stars begin to fall, my Lord, what a morning. My Lord, what a morning. My Lord, what a morning. When the stars begin to fall. Oh, Christian, what will you do? Oh, Christian, what will you do? Oh, Christian, what will you do when the stars begin to fall? We'll shout the shout of victory. We'll shout the shout of victory. We'll shout the shout of victory when the stars begin to fall. Everybody try it. My Lord, what a morning. It's a revival. Sing it out. My Lord, what a morning. My Lord, what a morning. When the stars begin to fall.
Although the song was carried through oral folk tradition, it is the written word morning that interests me. In the first two publications I mentioned, mourning is spelled with a U, as in mourning a death. Years later, the spiritual sometimes appeared in print as mourning, as in dawn. In one authoritative source written by the brothers James and Rosamond Johnson in 1925, the Book of American Negro Spirituals, one reads in the headnote of the spiritual, quote, "The title of this song has at times been erroneously printed, My Lord, What a Mourning with a U," unquote. I question how such a judgment was made about the spelling in a song that was essentially heard and learned orally, and not from the written word. Upon hearing the lyric, you may perceive the meaning of mourning either for death or dawn, or both at once. I've watched that fleeting moment in the night sky with stars gleaming when suddenly they disappear at the first light. In his 1903 book, Souls of Black Folks by W.E. Du Bois, he lists this song as the seventh of his list of 10 Master Sorrow songs, commenting that it is the song of the end, capital E, and the beginning, capital B. My Lord, with a mourning spelled with a U. Perhaps the words are about the end of slavery and the beginning of freedom, either on this earth or in heaven, with an intentional ambiguity of mourning as in poetry. By focusing on sinners, an interpretation of Judgment Day is possible when the stars fall. God destroys heaven and earth and separates the damned and the saved. Thus, three distinct interpretations are suggested by the song Break of Day, Mourning Loss on Earth, and Judgment Day. In 1918, it was a significant year for Emlyn. She completed her fieldwork in Gilboa and moved to Detroit, about 35 miles from Ypsilanti, leaving her position at the Michigan State Normal School and becoming an instructor of English at Detroit Junior College, which later became Wayne State University. She taught one of the college's first folklore classes, Stories for Settlement House Children. 5 years later, in 1923, Emlyn's father died. Although Miss Gardner was a successful teacher and a well-respected folklorist, and in spite of the many accolades she gained, she could not satisfy her father. Late in life, she wrote to a colleague, quote, "My parents were very practical people, and father always left the room when folklore was discussed by my folklore friends or distinguished scholars in the field, like Kittredge of Harvard, Boaz of Columbia, and Bronner of Michigan." While the influx of immigrants to Detroit in the 1920s, Professor Gardner became interested in their assimilation and taught English to foreign adults in night school. During her 24 years of teaching folklore and children's literature at Wayne, Gardner inspired many students to pursue the study of folklore and to collect the folklore of their own communities. Her pioneering work with immigrant folklore to urban Detroit is the foundation of the folklore archives at Wayne State University, which Gardner founded in 1939 with her colleague Thelma James. The archive includes collection of Polish, Italian, Armenian, Finnish, Greek, Yugoslavian, and Jewish lore, and is known as one of the oldest of its kind in the nation. Emlyn Gardner and Thelma James conducted folklore collecting projects in the city of Detroit, with students until Gardner retired in 1942. She was the first woman of the teaching staff, aside from department chairman, men, to be named a full professor. Many years later, she was additionally appointed as professor emeritus. After her retirement from Wayne University, Miss Gardner continued her work collecting folklore with the many ethnic groups that had recently settled in Detroit. It is unfortunate that the best recording equipment available to her was a small cylinder dictaphone designed for recording speech that poorly captured the audio range and dynamics of singers and musicians. In her correspondence with Alan Lomax, just before the United States entered World War II, Lomax asked her to consider trading copies of her recordings of the folklore minorities of Detroit to give to the Archive of American Folk Song of the Library of Congress in return for a portable recording machine with discs. While both parties were keenly interested in the trade, Lomax withdrew the offer. A few years after World War II ended, Emlyn, with her sister Lucy, moved to Pomona, California. The sisters, who lived together since the 1930s, remained unmarried throughout their lives. Emlyn spent her final years in a comfortable cottage surrounded by Victorian furniture and her books at a retirement home, Claremont Manor, in Claremont, California. She died at the age of 95 in 1967. A tombstone for her and her immediate family is seen today at the Evergreen Cemetery in Otego, New York, although she was interred in California. When we think of the mountains of Appalachia, most of us think of the southeastern region of the United States, but actually they geographically encompass 18 states from Georgia to Maine. When we consider the cultural traditions of folklore and music of Appalachia, most people think of only southern Appalachia. In fact, since the beginning of the 20th century, a myth has been perpetuated that the earliest known folk songs and tales brought to America can only be found in southern Appalachia. What is not commonly understood is that much of the same culture was brought by similar early immigrants to both regions. Gardner herself recognized this, telling a newspaper reporter in 1937, quote, "Both North and South Appalachia were settled in the same stock, the poorer classes of Western Europe and Great Britain who migrated to America in the 17th and 18th centuries to escape the oppression of church and state," end quote. 50 years later, in 1987, Simon Bronner, author of Old-Time Music Makers of New York State, criticized historians of traditional American music who, in his words, quote, "gave a false impression that British ballads in America persisted exclusively among the Southern Appalachian folk," unquote. Among these scholars, he included Bill C. Malone, author of the definitive Country Music USA, first published in 1968. Quote, "Malone is correct about finding historical conditions that helped to perpetuate a rurally based music that later developed into country music," Bonner wrote, adding, "but he is wrong in claiming that these conditions and the old-time music associated with them are unique to the South," unquote. To the list of erroneous mythmakers, I add John Lomax and his son, Alan, who worked for the Library of Congress and helped to create America's largest folk song collection, and to whom I am personally indebted, as their collection has enabled me to include historically accurate music in American history documentaries. Both father and son were from Texas. The largest body of music they collected was from southern United States. The North is unfortunately underrepresented. This is evident in their 1942 catalog, Checklist of Recorded Songs in the English Language in the Library of Congress Archive of American Folk Song in July 1940. It is an astounding and vast collection that is indexed both by title and by state where recorded. But there are no recordings from states in the Northwest or from New England, except some from Vermont. As for New York State recordings, they are represented by only three places: New York City, Ramapo, New York, and Sloatsburg. Is this evidence that there were few songs or singers available in the rest of New York? or evidence of a certain bias from the collectors. So much mythology has been perpetuated that it comes as a surprise to some people that New York had the same or similar songs as were heard in the South. The current name of the folk song archive at the Library of Congress is American Folklife Center. None of Professor Gardner's recordings are there, nor is she mentioned in a list of the earliest women folk song collectors on their American Memory website. I suspect this has happened because she entered the field earlier and had only Michigan support, not national support. Belatedly, the following appears on the website of the American Folklife Center, and I quote, "Women collectors at the beginning of the 20th century were pioneers in the field of ethnographic documentation and traveled to places where they encountered situations that were unusual for women at that time. Their field notes and correspondence provide commentaries on their experiences. By conducting research in the field, these women were venturing into scholarly territory previously occupied almost exclusively by men," end quote. I think there are differences in what kind of songs are collected between two women than between two men. A woman may be more inclined to know and sing a song that related to her domestic family life, her home, her children, whereas a man may be more inclined to know songs pertaining to his labor, sport, traveling, or drinking. Some examples of this are significant to Gardner's collection, in which women informants offer her two lullabies, a song that gives advice from a grandmother about false young men, and a song about spinning, in which the daughter's finger always hurts her so that she cannot spin until a husband has promised her. In contrast, around the same period as Gardner's Schoharie Hills collection, Robert Winslow Gordon collected songs on the West Coast at waterfronts where captains, sailors, stevedores, hobos, and convicts offered sea shanties and work songs. Many of those songs appeared later in the column he edited for the pulp magazine Adventure called Old Songs That Men Have Sung. Emily Gardner was pioneering with her Schoharie book and proving what a large part of our folklore, and specifically the songs, are international. Folklore scholars know that Gardner's collection of songs were seminal to the understanding that American folk songs are international, that they reflect the many ethnicities of its earliest settlers and pioneers. Her book became one of the first studies of a local folklore published in America. Her books and articles continue to be cited into the 21st century.